So let's talk about you and Jack Gantz. The Marla Grusoff sent some clippings, including one saying, In Search of a Soul, the Washington novel. I didn't consider this book a Washington novel at all. If anything, it's a novel of Chicago and a very heartfelt story about Chicago, its people, and its politicians. Are you a Chicagoan?
Yes.
Must be.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell me about your background.
Absolutely. My I come from a newspaper family. My father and grandfather were both newspaper publishers in Waukegan, Illinois, a little town just north of Chicago. And my family, both sides, I mean, my mother's side and my father's side, I mean, have way deep roots in Illinois and in Chicago. So I am definitely one of those characters that they call a Chicago boy. You don't call anybody a New York boy or a San Francisco boy, but somehow you say Chicago boy. I don't know why that is. Started out working for my father in the newspaper, the Waukegan News Sun, as a reporter. And it was one of those odd family things. My grandfather's a great editor, and my father was just a tremendous publisher. And there really wasn't much room for me on this. Unless you believe in, you know, that sort of families have to, you know, sort of carry these things down. And I had to get out of town. There was just too much. There was just too much weight hanging around
for your family. There's a legacy.
It's awful because you never know where you are. You never know, you know, what's yours and what's theirs. And your position inside the newspaper is so peculiar because it's a family-owned paper. There's no question that if I were there right now, I would be the publisher, probably the editor and publisher. So they know, everybody there knows the kind of track that you're on. And you're living this kind of unreal world. I don't claim that it has its attractions. I mean, among other things, you got a guaranteed job, right? It's inside work. There's no heavy lifting. That's so to that extent.
Well,
that depends
on your old man.
But that's fair enough.
You start out there in the warehouse loading those bales of paper.
That's right. And I worked for my old man for a couple of years, and finally departed and went to New York to try to find a job.
Where did you go to school?
We went to school at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Never graduated, but sort of attended for 4 years. I was one of those people. I hated the academic life. I didn't do especially well at it. I just wanted to get out of college and go to work. I loved the workday world. I loved the world of work and whatnot. And indeed, most of all, my fiction is partly about work. I've never written written a novel or a short story where they are always identified, at least partly identified, by what they do. And that's just a direct reflection of my own feeling. I just loved the world of work, particularly newspapers, as an ambiance. So I came to New York for hung around here for 6 months trying to find a job.
This was approximately when?
The year 1959. And, it was hard. Not so hard as it is now. I mean, there were, the business was expanding and whatnot. But if your kid out of
there
Waukegan...
There were newspapers back there then.
Oh, a lot of papers around. I came out with my fistful of clippings from the Waukegan News Sun, and nobody had ever heard about that. But I was lucky enough to meet a guy, an exceptionally nice man at Newsweek, called John McAllister. McAllister took me on as a trainee and immediately sent me back to Chicago, where I stayed for a couple of years. And then I was called, and it virtually amounts to a call, like a religious call, up to the show in Washington. I was in the Washington Bureau for a while and then went to Europe for a couple of years and came back and joined the Washington Post in 65, went to Vietnam in 66 and 67, and then quit the show to write fiction in 1970.
How could you swing that?
How do you mean?
That's what everybody wants to do.
Yeah. It's funny. I think that it's what everybody wanted to do then. I'm not so damn sure it's what they want to do now. At that time, we all had novels in the desk drawer. Everybody that you knew was trying to work on a novel. I don't know anybody that's working on a novel now. I know a lot of people who are working on, maybe they've got an idea for a thriller or something like that, but to all of a sudden a sign that you're going to write what is, in essence, is, I suppose, non-popular fiction, not potboilers in any event. I don't know anybody who's thinking about that. Maybe they are. You're closer to the business than I am, and if you say so, I'll believe it. But I don't know very many newsmen who are doing that now. A million of them were back then.
How did that first novel come about? Tell me about it.
My wife and I went up to New Hampshire for the summer. I took a leave of absence from the Post. I was then on the editorial page. And I had this idea. I was at that point still, and was for a long time, obsessed by Vietnam. And I wrote a novel which was not set in Vietnam, but it was in fact set in Latin America. I didn't want to make it a Vietnam novel, but the whole experience was informed by Vietnam. It's called A Soldier of the Revolution, a man who gets himself involved in some local guerrillas. And I wrote it in 3 months. I can hardly write a letter today in 3 months, but I wrote this novel in 3 months. And it's a first novel. It's what it is, you know, you're sort of trying to learn the trade. But Knopf bought it and published it, and the reviews weren't very good. But there were a few that were all right. That was the time when you're young enough, you really pay attention to reviews in the way that you, I think, don't maybe when you get a little older. The book was published, and in fact, I think it was published in 2 or 3 foreign countries. It wasn't a tremendous success. It wasn't a great, you know, financial success, but it was enough to encourage one to go on and to make me think that if I really sat down and did it, then I might actually begin to write some fiction that might have some meaning for people or for myself. And so a year later, I quit the Washington Post and just struck out and started to write fiction. That was in 1970.
So you really got the bug.
Yeah. Yeah. When it bites, it bites hard. It bites just as hard as the newspaper bug. I had that too, but it.
But the writing is so different, isn't it?
Oh yeah, my goodness. You have to unlearn a whole set of principles that you live by. You almost have to invert the technique in a proper newspaper story, I think. I mean, when you're really writing newspaper copy of a certain quality, it's almost like a little Bach fugue or quartet or something like that. You must follow the notes absolutely strictly. You can vary the tempo a little bit, but you must follow the notes, which is to say the facts, and it's done. If you're doing it really at a certain level, the one thing kind of follows the other. A novel is kind of a jazz band. You deal yourself a hand. I mean, you deal yourself a hand in the first couple of chapters, and you got to play out that hand. You can deal yourself a new hand, which means you throw away the 2 chapters that you've written, and then you decide to deal yourself a new hand if you want. But you deal a hand, and you can play the cards in an infinite variety of ways. You can't do that with a properly written newspaper story. Thinking or
properly written nonfiction.
Nonfiction. But I'm thinking less of books than I am. I'm trying to make the comparison, between writing a novel and writing, you know, newspaper stuff.
But a newspaper story, a nonfiction book, for example, here's a book, I just interviewed the author, The Last Days of the New Yorker.
Ah, yes.
I don't believe that she is inherently a journalist, and yet this is a journalistic effort.
Yes.
It's a nonfiction book with appropriate quotations.
Yes.
And it seems to be a lot, the sort of, if this could well be excerpted, I think, in a newspaper in work.
Yes. Sure. Yeah, I skipped a beat. I see what you mean. The same thing would absolutely be true. You've got a certain number of facts. You've got the New Yorker, and the Fleischmanns owned it, and then and the Newhouses bought it, and you've got a certain number of shares were outstanding, and a certain amount of money that was paid, and the certain personalities involved. There is some variety that you can use within that. You can choose to start here as opposed to there. You can flashback and you can do this and that. But you are basically governed by the facts that you have. A novel's not quite like that, except for these cards that you deal yourself, the first couple of chapters that you're obliged to play out in the infinite variety of ways.
Of course, a novel must also contain the facts. For example, you have a terrific mm-hmm. portrait of Chicago in here, and it could only be Chicago.
Yeah.
You couldn't do anything else. You have to be true to these things, don't
yes.
you? Or you would be described as perhaps, there's this form of literature called postmodernism or something.
Yeah.
Robert Coover does it and a few yeah. people like that, and you read it and you don't know, it has no relationship to reality.
Exactly. You don't know where you've got real people marching in and
right.
out, and you don't know sort of where you are with them, and you don't know what's made up. And I guess like you, I have some difficulty with that. I can't get, there's a certain form of things, maybe because of my years as a journalist, that, I mean, there should be some kind of line, except, of course, when there isn't. Tolstoy's book, War and Peace, has got people, you know, it's got real people, but, you know, running around all over the Battle of Borodino and all the rest of it. You mentioned the portrait of Chicago. It does not have, I think, to be accurate, I mean, as you and I think, would think of as accurate in all respects, but it must be absolutely faithful to the spirit of the thing. I mean, and that's really what you're trying to get at. I think
yeah.
Anybody who knows Chicago, I would hope, you know, as they get into, say, chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5 in that book, that it is absolutely recognizable. They know exactly where they are, and I would like to think that's not because the place names are right or the streets are right, but because the language evokes the spirit of the place, the way people talk to each other, or as often is the case in Chicago, talk at and past each other, that there's a particular style of conversation in Chicago that's just that isn't like New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles. It's recognizably Chicago, I think.
Well, I believe Jack Gance is your 11th book of fiction?
10th.
10th. Did you obviously had no trouble then making the transition from newspaper reporter, writer to novelist?
No.
It's like that, right?
Well, I had, yeah, I mean, it was, yeah. Yeah, like that. It was a terribly hard thing. I mean, the books, I mean, I like to believe that the books keep getting better. I didn't have any trouble with ideas of what I wanted to do. It was a question of execution, because I was very, very far into the newspaper business. I really loved the Dodge, and I loved the people in it, and liked the milieu and the rest of it. And a lot of that had to be put to one side in order to make a novel that's a real novel. It's not a Romana Clay. It's not a commentary. And it's a real thing all of its own. And you create a character, and the character is himself or herself. Not some pale shadow of you know, some real figure. And that, to learn to do that, does not come in a minute and a half. Sure doesn't.
Well, tell me how Jack Gance came about.
Jack Gance came about, I wanted to write, it's kind of a quirky romance, and I had this wonderful idea that I thought would make a terrific short story. So I worked on it for a while, and it didn't seem quite right as a short story. And then I decided, well, it's probably a novella. And I'd written a couple of those before, and I was just sort of despaired when I thought about that, because, among other things, there's no place you can sell a novella today. You can write it, but no one will read it because no one will publish it. And I define a novella as somewhere between 15,000-20,000 words, something like that. Nobody will publish it. And so it's sort of with a heavy heart I started to work on the novella. And the novella didn't quite work. Well, actually, I thought it worked all right. And in the process of tinkering with the novella to get it correct, to think if maybe I could sell it to somebody, I didn't even think who, because nobody publishes it, I got another idea and chopped away two-thirds of the novella, started with just a little bit of a kernel. And I realized that what I really had was a novel, and the rest of it was all decoration that had to be done away with. And 2.5 years later, Jack Gance appears. And I, all of a sudden, I take it I probably missed the point of your question, which is, well, why Jack Gantz? I mean, why? The,
yeah,
you know,
well,
why?
You told me in technical terms how it came about, but in novelistic terms now, here we have Jack. I think one of the most poignant portions of the book is his relationship with his father, who, as the reader will find out, early on is sent to prison for income tax evasion. And Jack's fledgling years as a, I guess, doing surveys for the local
for the political
party,
machine,
local
yeah.
political machine, and developing grandiose ideas himself about going into higher politics. So these are characters that had to spring from some source. So you must have had some idea about the people that populated your book.
Yeah. I started out this way that I've been. Getting into, I guess as I get older, I am increasingly interested in the Midwest of the 1940s and 50s. That flat vista, that sense of really being enclosed and pressed upon by both coasts, the kind of riotous West Coast and the sort of immigrant-filled East Coast, pressed like this. People trying to hold on to values really from the sort of century before. Chicago, tough as it is, brawling as it is, has got this odd sentimental streak to it. And I wanted to take somebody from that environment, and plainly this is a bit of a gloss on my own life, myself. I wanted to take somebody out of that environment with all that that implied. Having very, very well educated, as I was not, but and that's where you begin to create another kind of character, and then send him to Washington in as the Kennedy the advent of the Kennedy administration in the year 1961, which was an administration I believe unlike no other that we've ever seen and will probably never see again, and you know, sort of in quite that way, this tremendous dramatic change from those Republican businessmen of the Eisenhower administration, all of a sudden yielding to this glamour, Harvard professors and all the rest, and how a young Midwesterner would react to that world, which would fundamentally, he would look on that a little bit askance, because it doesn't really accord with anything that he has seen in the Midwest. Once you have that, once you start out with, in essence, this kind of flat vista, and remember the book begins in whatever the hell year it is, 1943, 1944, Jack Gantz is a young boy, 8-year-old boy, on this flat lake in Wisconsin, fishing. And it goes right from there to, you know, whatever, 15 years later when he's, you know, sort of, you know, out of college and goes to work for the machine. And tries to understand the levers of power, what they are really, as opposed to what we read about him on the front pages of the paper. What kind of people that is he obliged to deal with, and the kind of machine politician that he was dealing with in Chicago is very, very different from the kind of politician that he learns to deal with in Washington, and then begins to examine his own life as consummate insider. At the three-quarters of the way through the book, he is not just an insider. He's really sort of an insider's insider, so far inside the woodwork that he and the woodwork are indistinguishable from each other. There they are together, and he ends up as a sort of mid-level assistant in the White House.
These insiders always seem to harbor the goal of becoming a candidate, and certainly Jack was no different. Isn't that true?
Yes, exactly.
It's like in the broadcast industry, or even in the newspaper industry, an advertising man secretly always wants to be an editorial person or an account executive at CBS. Yeah. Secretly wants to be an anchorman.
Exactly.
Always
wants to be Mike Wallace.
Well, everybody wants to be Mike Wallace, but I can see this. Here's Jack working behind the scenes. And yet, somewhere he's still, I didn't quite see him as the candidate somehow. He seemed to be too introspective. But he always wanted to be that.
Well, remember the thing that drives him into candidacy is the decline of the Midwest, and he is appalled by it. The Rust Belt, the terrible racial tensions that began to spring up in the city of Chicago. And there's a little passage in there about the region losing its confidence, which it sure did in the latter 70s and early 80s, after the death of Richard J. Daley. In part, Chicago had always been, there was the aspect of a Potemkin village about Chicago, but all of a sudden it was as if even the fake walls came down to reveal the even shabbier walls, behind. Jack is a true dyed-in-the-wool Midwesterner in Chicago. He's horrified by what he sees and seems to think that somehow he has a debt to the region, and by running for office, in this case the United States Senate, he can repay that debt, and which of course leads to the golf game with Ellie Mozart, Chicago's legendary political fixer, and then his campaign, and the run out of the rest of the book.
I have a feeling that Jack is going to wind up being a good senator.
Yes. I think that's true. I think Jack is going to wind up to be a pretty good senator. And not such a swell guy, maybe, but a pretty good senator. He's going to vote the way you would, a reasonable person would like a United States senator to vote. That has been purchased at some personal cost, and it's that cost, the implications of what that costs are, those costs are to him, that comprises the last chapter of the book.
I have a feeling that I might be reading about Jack Gantz in the future. I think there's more to be told.
Yeah, I agree with you, and it's odd. I was funny. I thought about a sequel, and then my wife and I moved to Paris 2.5 years ago, and I've become so fascinated with the expatriate community in Paris that I'm working on something with that now. I may come back to Jack in the future. There's more to be told. I think.
And let it sink in for a while.
But you have to let it. It's like a compost heap.
What prompted you to go to Paris?
We sort of rare at my age anyway. We in effect got a free year. We didn't have to be anywhere, and. I was finishing up a writer-in-residence stint at Andover, the prep school in Massachusetts. And we looked up one fine day and said, well, we didn't want to stay in Andover. There was no point to that. Didn't really care to go to Boston. Didn't want to go to New York.
You have a house and furniture?
We just had a rented, kind of a rented place there. So we said to ourselves, well, it was really my wife's idea. Why don't we go to Paris for a year? And why not? what's not to like about Paris? And, the cost of living is no more expensive than it is. It's less than this city, but about the same as Boston or Washington, something like that. So, and it turned out to be both in terms of the kind of quality of fun that you have in that city. But more than that, It treats somebody like me, who's really is an inside man, I mean, who sort of sits around at a typewriter all day long, wonderfully kindly. I know of no city that's easier and more agreeable to live in than Paris. Parisians love the Americans.
I would think it'd be, for me, I think it'd be very hard. If I went there to write, for example, I'd have to deal with the language, which I only speak in drips and drabs, and the currency, and the customs, and the climate, friends. I would go there without friends. And it would seem to me there would be so many distractions that it would be hard to do.
The odd thing is, it's a terrible thing to say, I don't say it with any pride, you don't have to learn the language. That's the odd part about it. And the currency is all picked up quickly enough. I was in the newspaper business long enough so that a lot of people that I used to know, are now hanging out in Europe. Either they're based in Bonn or based in Paris or based in London. And so there's a whole coterie of the old foreign correspondent gang, that hung out together in South Vietnam. And, of course, they're the jolliest people in the world, to get together with. There's nobody more fun than a foreign correspondent to hang out. So we see a lot of them and a lot of other people. It's a very, very friendly, hospitable place. The French have got the most awful bad rap about, you know, sort of for rudeness and whatnot. My wife and I don't, you know, don't see it.
It sounds like a wonderful experience.
Are
you going to stay?
Yeah. I mean, we're going to stay as long as we can afford to stay. I mean, it depends on the exchange rate, I guess. I don't know. Yeah, we'll stay for, we will stay for a while.
What was, you were teaching creative writing, is that correct?
Well, yes.
Writer in residence.
Yeah, I was teaching short stories, and I taught one course that I was really very proud of that I don't think there was another one like it in secondary education. I had these 17-year-olds write a novella in a semester's time.
But where are they going to get it published?
That's... At 17, you don't have to get it published. All you have to do is get it finished.
And graded.
Exactly. Finished and graded. Exactly. So so that was a lot of fun. I mean, the kids at that age have all that, you know, sort of energy. And I happened to be blessed. I had a lot of very good students. School was a very agreeable place to be. So it was a fun couple of years. But then I had to get back to my own work because it'll take a lot of your time teaching. Teaching is no easy rap.
Ever go back to it, do you think?
No, I don't think so. It the way to do it, though, is the way I did it. I would much rather teach 17 or 18-year-olds or 16-year-olds than when they get into college, because at 16, 17, they really haven't got any bad habits. I mean, they're not old enough to have bad habits. They don't necessarily have good ones either, but you really can teach. It was fun, very enjoyable, but you can't, if you're really interested in getting your own work done, you know, which I was and I am, teaching is tough unless you have to do it.
Well, I think it would be harder on the level in which you were teaching. It would seem to me that if you landed a college job where you conducted, say, one or two workshops a week.
That could be. I hadn't thought about that. That may be. I find, though, that you get so involved in the students' work. And that it, and particularly if you've got a couple, three really good ones, and at that age when they're good, they're sort of all over the place. It's like a racehorse that you can't keep, you know, in control. You get much more interested in what they're doing than what you're doing.
Well, Updike said something very similar to me once. He filled in at a writing workshop in Harvard, and he kept looking at the material that came into him from the students, and he said, their stuff was as good as mine. He said it got me so confused that he didn't want to teach anymore.
Yeah, it's very interesting because at 16 and 17, they really didn't have much concept of sort of pacing and form. All that can be taught, but occasionally these amazing sentences and conceptions of things would fly out of these heads of babes, and it was very daunting. It really was. I know exactly what Updike means. It's true. It's very daunting indeed.
Well, it shows that even we as children listen.
Yeah.
And if you start to write, sometimes what we have heard, if not what we have read, comes zinging through.
Yep.
And I'm sure that a lot of what they wrote was a derivative, probably a lot of science fiction, but every once in a while some stellar thought would come through.
That's
maybe
true.
An argument they heard in their household, and they retain that, some traumatic event, and all of a sudden you would see this on paper and say, boy, that kid is really, he's really got
one
some
of the,
ideas.
One of the most extraordinary stories I had was just that. A black kid out of Harlem who was at Andover, I think, going to one of their outreach programs. Well, one of the most extraordinary stories that I have ever read about just exactly that. An argument between his father and his older brother. It was a story of such explosion to it, and beautifully rendered, not well finished. It was a rough draft, but if he never wanted to work on it again, didn't want to, you know, go back and make it sort of truly publishable, which it was absolutely in my opinion, but it was so unfinished, it just would have taken some kind of turning of the screw and whatnot, but it had a power and a consequence to it. I mean, it wasn't some suburban tea party. It was, you know, that was life. That was, I mean, and he just ripped that thing right out. Lovely damn story.
But it's hard work to write, isn't
it? Oh, boy. Yeah. In this case, with this kid,
Well, that's why I probably didn't go back to it, not for any emotional reason, but because it's so hard.
Yeah.
I have to sit there by myself and do it. It's so hard.
Yeah.
And it takes so much energy, and I think it takes a very special person to... I mean, you go to the bookstores and you see thousands of books around you, and yet it takes a special person to do it, because it is it's a tough racket. I think it's harder than newspaper work.
Yes. I think it's, and among other reasons that it's hard is that the gratification from it is so delayed. I mean, it's 2 years between applause, and sometimes you don't get the applause. There isn't that with newspaper work. That's always that thing, if you're feeling a little bit squirrely inside, you know, you can always write something and it'll show up, and there it'll be in there. You know, you really do exist. There's the byline and whatnot. But you're trying to write books, and a long time between appearances.
Don't stop, Jack Ants. It's a marvelous book. I thank you very, very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.